Israel's indiscriminate strikes claim more civilian lives across the Gaza Strip as the death toll for regime's genocide tops 26,600. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it wants a complete and comprehensive ceasefire in Gaza, rejecting any temporary truce with Israel. In retaliation for Israeli crimes in Gaza, Palestinian resistance fighters fire a volley of rockets at Tel Aviv. We'll start this bulletin with the latest from Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Regime has struck residential buildings throughout the besieged enclave, killing more than 200 people in 24 hours. Over a dozen civilians, mostly women and children, were killed in a strike that targeted a building in Gaza City. Israeli warplanes bombed Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, while residential buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis were also shelled. Overall death toll now stands at over 26,600. Head of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says the healthcare system in Gaza is on the brink of collapse. Officials in Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis say they have suspended surgeries due to lack of oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been a central target of Israel's attacks. Regime forces have also struck ambulances marked with Red Cross or Red Crescent emblems, often in proximity to hospitals. And earlier we spoke to our correspondent in Gaza Strip, Moti Abu Musabe, about the latest developments there. Here he is.
The Israeli warplanes are carrying out several fire belts targeting residential buildings and residential areas in the western parts of Gaza City, while several populated residential buildings in Asabra neighborhood as well were targeted by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. In the same context, it's worth mentioning that the Israeli tanks are still positioning in the surrounding areas of Al-Shifa Medical Complex, a few meters away from the gate of the complex, preventing anyone else from moving in the city. And anyone moves in the surrounding area is shot by the Israeli tanks and by the Israeli forces. Because, as you know, that the Israeli forces unleashed and dispatched several leaflets demanding the Palestinian civilians who are still living in the city to evacuate wide parts and wide residential squares to the south, claiming that the central area and the south are safe areas. It's worth mentioning as well that the Palestinian people in Gaza City are still suffering from disastrous humanitarian conditions as the Israeli occupation forces prevent any entry of the basic humanitarian needs into the city, leaving the people in a real starvation there.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has ruled out any temporary truce with Israel in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Tahir al-Nunu called for a complete and comprehensive ceasefire before any prisoner exchange deal with Israel. He added the regime's hindering an accord because it's at odds with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's personal interests. Earlier, the Qatari Prime Minister had said progress was being made on securing a prisoner swap between Hamas and the Israeli regime. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman al-Thani announced a prisoner swap framework will be communicated to Hamas. He made that announcement after meeting with U.S. and Egyptian officials and Israeli representatives in Paris. And Palestinian resistance movements continue fighting invading Israeli forces in Gaza and launching retaliatory attacks deep in occupied territories. Military wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigades, launched 15 missiles at Tel Aviv. Sirens were heard south of occupied territories as well. There's been no word on damage or casualties as of yet. Meanwhile, heavy fighting is underway between resistance fighters and Israeli forces northwest of Gaza. The resistance factions say one of the main Israeli logistics support points was hit, located in the Al-Sudani area. The base was used to deliver weapons, food, fuel to IOF soldiers. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids in several areas of the occupied West Bank, killing at least five Palestinians. Two were killed in an Israeli incursion into Al-Khalil. The regime also carried out a separate raid into Jenin, killing another Palestinian there. And the fourth victim was a student killed by regime forces in Bethlehem. Another Palestinian was shot dead during a military raid on Silwad. Israel has carried out raids throughout the occupied West Bank almost on a daily basis since the regime began its onslaught on Gaza on the 7th of October. They've left over 370 Palestinians dead. Moni Candio says several Palestinians have recently been killed by Israeli forces throughout the occupied West Bank. Here she is.
Israeli forces opened fire at one of the Palestinians in Silwad, and he is from Silwad, 19-year-old Abdulrahman Hamid from Silwad, shot him and killed him. In the other area of the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces had raided the village of Dura in Al-Khalil, and during the incursion to Dura, Israeli forces claimed that Palestinians hurled rocks and stones at the Israeli military vehicles. We are speaking about Israeli armored vehicles that the young Palestinians from Dura threw stones and rocks, hurled the stones and rocks in order to prevent, as well as the incursion, to defend themselves and their homes and their lands. This is what the Israelis claimed earlier. In the city of Jenin, or in the area near Jenin, Israeli forces had raided the town of Al Yamun near Jenin. Clashes had erupted between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces. The operation that lasted for over 5 hours in Al Yamun, in Jenin city and the refugee camp of Jenin, during this military operation to these areas, Israeli forces shot and killed Tha'el Hammo in the village of Al Yamun.
Now, a call by Israeli ministers for the re-establishment of settlements in the Gaza Strip has sparked international backlash. Nearly a third of the ministers in the Israeli cabinet attended a conference that called for mass Palestinian displacement from Gaza and return of settlers. A Palestinian foreign ministry slammed the meeting as colonial. Hamas said the conference reveals Israeli intentions to implement the crimes of displacement and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Israel's Western allies also condemned the meeting with France, saying it's not up to Israel to decide where Palestinians should live, while Germany rejected the meeting as unacceptable. U.S. also condemned the remarks made at the meeting as reckless and incendiary. An Israeli airstrike has hit the Syrian capital Damascus, leaving several civilians dead and injured. Attack targeted a neighborhood near Sayyidina Zainab Shrine in southern Damascus. According to a Syrian military source, strikes were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. Local media says Syrian air defenses were activated, but a residential building was still hit. Tehran has denied reports the building belonged to Iran's military advisors or there were Iranian casualties involved. Israel repeatedly targets Syria with missiles and warplanes. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it's inflicted losses on Israeli occupation soldiers in its latest retaliatory attacks, as Mariam saw the reports from Lebanon.
Well, Hezbollah has vowed, of course, to continue their resistance operations as long as the onslaught on Gaza continues, and they seem to be escalating, just as the Israelis are also escalating with their targeting of areas that are getting closer to the civilian population in South Lebanon and also getting further away from the border. Hezbollah has targeted on three different occasions groups of soldiers, but it seems that Hezbollah has increasingly been targeting soldiers direct. And so wherever they see any movement or a stationed group of Israeli soldiers, they seem to target them directly. Just recently, they targeted a group of soldiers in the Al-Sumaqa barracks in the occupied Shifa farms. They also targeted another group of soldiers in the Hunin fort. It's not in the occupied Shifa farms, that is in occupied Palestinian territory. And another instance was in Zar'it. And so we've got three different examples of Hezbollah targeting Israeli soldiers, and that is just not just one part of Hezbollah's resistance operations today, but they said that they directly targeted the soldiers. They know that they scored significant hits when it came to how they targeted them, but they did not mention in all their statements what type of arms they were using. They said the appropriate missiles or missile rockets. In some cases, they do mention. Now, we do know that Hezbollah has been using anti-tank and anti-armored missiles in a manner that is quite significant and new.
Iran has denied responsibility for actions of resistance groups targeting U.S. interests in the region. The Iranian ambassador to the U.N. said the country does not directly or indirectly control any groups in Syria, Iraq, or elsewhere in the region. Amir Said Iravani made the comments in a letter to the Security Council president. He was responding to what he described as unfounded U.S. allegations linking Iran to attacks on U.S. facilities and personnel. Iravani also stressed U.S. actions in Syria and Iraq are in violation of international law and the U.N. Charter. Regional resistance groups have been carrying out almost daily attacks on U.S. bases since Israel launched an onslaught on Gaza on October 7th. They hold the U.S. responsible for Israeli genocide in the Strip due to its military and diplomatic support for the Israeli regime. The U.S. and its Western allies have spared no effort in pursuing a hostile approach toward Tehran. Washington and London have jointly announced a fresh round of sanctions against a number of Iranian officials. 11 individuals, including senior IRGC officials and an organization, have been blacklisted. They're facing sanctions under the pretext of alleged connection to networks involved in targeting anti-Iran dissidents outside of the Islamic Republic. According to U.S. State Department, or pardon, Department of Treasury, sanctions include bans on transactions and travel and asset freezes. Iran's yet to react to the move. Tehran's repeatedly denied similar allegations in the past, though the U.S. and its backers have a long record of imposing sanctions against Iran under various pretexts aimed at isolating the country to no avail. Political commentator George Zamuli says the U.S. doesn't want to address its unconditional support for Israel's horrific actions in the region, so he believes Washington's imposing sanctions on Tehran in an attempt to frame it as responsible for problems of the region.
The U.S. is obviously failing very badly in its policy in the Middle East. It's rightly, throughout the Middle East, it's being held to account for its unconditional support for Israel and Israel's horrific policies in Gaza. And it is acting as Israel's enabler. So rather than address that issue, the United States is trying to change the subject. And so it tries to change the subject as always. Oh, Iran, it's about Iran. But it really isn't about Iran. It's about Israel, what Israel is doing, and the United States' policy in facilitating what Israel is doing.
Tehran and Islamabad emphasize joint efforts in the fight against terrorism as a threat to both countries. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff General Sayed Asim Munir expressed determination to maintain close cooperation. In a meeting in the Pakistani city of Rawalpindi, two sides agreed to implement a mechanism to deploy military liaison officers to fight common threats. Iran and Pakistani top officials also stressed commitment to promoting peace and stability along border areas. The Iranian foreign minister also met with the Pakistani premier, Anwar ul-Haq Kakar, discussing the expansion of economic ties at the joint borders. Amir Abdullahian already met with his Pakistani counterpart, emphasizing a necessity to further take steps to combat terrorism.
The two high-ranking delegates and delegations of Pakistan and Iran, we agreed together in order to take further actions as soon as possible when it comes to border security, necessity of fighting against terrorism, expansion of trade, commercial and economic cooperation, establishment of the joint border markets, and opening of the border crossing, as well as establishment of the free trade zones.
Amir Abdullah made the remarks in a joint press tour with his Pakistani counterpart in Islamabad, where he said Iran and Pakistan will cooperate to prevent terrorists from endangering the security of the two nations, noting Iran considers Pakistan's security as its own and that of the entire region. First part, Jalil Abbas Jilani said two countries have agreed to establish a high-level consultation mechanism to fight terrorism. A Pakistani top diplomat added Tehran and Islamabad will also take measures to improve economic ties. South African journalists have signed a statement demanding an end to targeting their Palestinian counterparts, saying Israel cannot act with impunity. Hassan Syria reports.
Among Israel's countless atrocities is its killing of journalists, which has passed 100 during the current onslaught on Gaza. South African journalists have come out in at least four cities across the country to commemorate their slain colleagues.
We gather not only to commemorate our fallen peers, but to confront the heavy toll of the conflict. Conflict, as what the media like to say. The tally of the human lives lost, the countless narrative left untold, and the voices, forever silenced.
As the latest Israeli assault on Gaza has reflected the clear divide of the media, it is not objectivity, but truth that protesters are demanding. Veteran journalists who covered the apartheid struggle in South Africa say you cannot get any closer to the story than the journalists in Gaza. They note that only those who capture the realities as they play out on the ground fall into this category. In their opinion, journalists who are embedded with the Israeli media and have subjected their work to regime vetting have compromised the story. South African veteran correspondents also challenge the Western attitude towards the figures reported from Gaza, including the number of journalists killed.
What anyone who disputes the numbers is saying to us is that we don't trust the reporting because you're Arab or because you're Palestinian. Nobody whose office is in Europe can tell me that what my colleague in Ramallah tells me is not true. So there's that's the contradiction.
With at least one journalist killed daily in the ongoing Israeli aggression, South African media practitioners want international law to be upheld and an end to the killing of their colleagues. They say the death of journalists mean a blackout of truth. Hassan Syria, Cape Town.
Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
The Al-Aqsa storm operation has irreversibly redefined the battlefield dynamics, especially with the Palestinian resistance stunning the military pundits in the West, with its preparedness and the ability to inflict heavy and irreparable blows to the occupying Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted the past 15 weeks have been marked by the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime genocidal aggression on the Gaza Strip, with the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas surprising all and sundry with its massive weapons arsenal, all of them locally manufactured. Toward the end of 2023, the martyr Ezzeddin Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, published a video showing its missile arsenal that is able to reach every nook and corner of the occupied territories. And more than 3 months after the Zionist regime launched its aggression, followed by extensive operations by the resistance groups against the occupation forces, this arsenal remains intact. Military experts in the West acknowledge that the Israeli regime, with all its advanced and sophisticated weapon systems imported from the United States and Europe, has been unable to match up to the armed wings of the Palestinian resistance groups and their fighters. Despite the Zionist regime dropping 67,000 tons of bombs on Gaza since October 7th, the resistance continues to grow and inflict heavy blows on the structure of the Zionist occupation. The story of the Palestinian missile program is a story of decades of sacrifice, ingenuity, dedicated work, and successful management, and above all, the defiant spirit of resistance. This long and difficult path of resistance against the apartheid regime began with Palestinian stone-throwing at Israeli armored vehicles during two intifadas and ended with the capability to launch 5,000 rockets in one day and a rocket arsenal sufficient for months of warfare. The missile capabilities and scope of operations displayed by the Hamas and other Palestinian groups surprised all international observers, even the Zionist intelligence services. What is particularly intriguing are the conditions in which the operation was carried out. Pertinently, the Gaza Strip was under Israeli occupation from 1967 to 2005, and ever since has been under a fierce land, sea, and air blockade that prevents the import of not only weapons, but also materials for their production as well as basic goods. The Zionist regime tried everything to weaken the resistance and retain the military technological advantage so that it could easily eliminate the groups that have been fighting for the liberation of Palestine. An example that illustrates this disparity is the Gaza massacre of 15 years ago, when hundreds of Palestinian civilians were killed by the Zionist regime's bombs. Hundreds of Israeli civilians, the so-called war tourists, gathered on the nearby hills and cheered triumphantly. However, times have changed since that gruesome, bloodthirsty cheering by the Zionist settlers that was followed by the iconic photo of a Palestinian boy throwing a rock at an Israeli tank. The Palestinian resistance initially relied on rudimentary weapons, smuggled or domestically produced, intended for close combat and countering invading forces on their soil. After years of usage of assault rifles and explosives, a simple Qassam rocket appeared in 2001 with a range of a handful of kilometers and low destructive power, which for the first time made possible a retaliatory strike against the Israeli occupation. Over time, the efficiency of the Qassam models increased and the first Israeli military bases and occupied cities came within range in 2010s, which caused the phenomenon of war tourists on the borders of Gaza to fall into oblivion suddenly. The Zionist regime made an effort to stop the effectiveness of these rocket attacks by developing a warning system. It invested a staggering amount of money in the development of Iron Dome, a military system that turned out to be a miserable failure on October 7th. It also boasted about assassinating the Hamas rocket engineers responsible for the Qassam development, thinking it might cripple the Palestinian brain trust or deter new generations from engaging in development, which proved to be a blowback assessment. Today, the Palestinian resistance has rockets with a range of hundreds of kilometers and warheads with a payload of hundreds of kilograms, capable of reaching any point in the occupied Palestinian territories called Israel. Due to their size, it is not possible to smuggle these rockets from abroad into the Gaza Strip, especially not in such huge quantities, which proves that they are the result of local production, industrial production, in conditions of a scarcity of necessary materials and exposure to the Zionist regime's airstrikes is an impressive feat in itself. Production facilities are scattered underground and well hidden, which requires exceptional logistical skills. The same applies to the supply of materials, which mainly comes from recycling raw materials such as old water pipes, anchors of destroyed buildings, streetlight poles, and so on. In an astonishing feat from 2020, Hamas naval commandos managed to salvage large 170-kilogram naval shells from a British warship that sunk offshore more than 100 years ago during the First World War and made them reusable for new missiles. The rocket engines and guidance systems are the product of cooperation and military knowledge imparted by experts in the region, especially Iran. The missiles revealed in the new video include the Maqadma and Jabari rocket family, both with a range of 90 kilometers and 50 kilogram warheads put into service in early 2010s. Development in the middle of the same decade witnessed the creation of the Attar rocket family with a range of 90 kilometers and 50 kilograms warhead, as well as the Rantisi rocket family with a range of 170 kilometers and 100 kilogram warhead. Firstly, at the end of 2010s, the Ayash rocket family was put into service with a range of 250 kilometers and a payload of 250 kilograms, the most powerful rocket in the Palestinian arsenal, used for strikes on Safed and Eilat during the Al-Aqsa flood operation. At the same time, the Sejil rocket family with a range of 55 kilometers and 50 kilogram warhead was also introduced, followed by the Shamala rocket family with a range of 80 kilometers and 150 kilogram warhead. Except for the Sejil rocket series, which is named after a Quranic verse, All others are named after Palestinian martyrs, namely Ibrahim al-Maghadma, Ahmad al-Jabari, Raed al-Attar, Abdulaziz al-Rantisi, Muhammad Abu Shamala, and Yahya Ayyash. For three decades, the Zionist regime thought that these assassinations would break the spirit of resistance and their technological development, which backfired in a way it could not have imagined. The martyrs and the missiles named after them are today giving sleepless nights to the child killer regime of Israel.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Hi, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Hali Saravi, your host at The Viewpoint. Here in the studio, I'm accompanied by Brother Ali from the Islamic Seminary of Qom, and also Sheikh Rouhani. He's a scholar and a researcher at universities in Qom. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, today we're going to talk about a very important topic, one which has been talked about many times, but it's always new. The personality of a great character, Imam Ali. And, you know, it's to talk about his personality is so difficult, don't you think? Isn't it difficult? It's so hard to talk about his personality. But I'm going to ask a very cliche question, but very crucial question. What is a very important character in his personality? If you want to think about his personality and if you want to bring out part of his personality, because he's a very, very multi-rounded personality. He has a very multi-rounded personality. So what is this part that you want to mention, if you could just show us only one face of his personality?
When it comes to the generosity, he is the most generous person. When it comes to the fields of knowledge, he is the most knowledgeable person. When it comes to the battlefield, he is the most, let's say, powerful and courageous warrior. When it comes to the ruling over the nation or the people managing, and it comes to the politics, he is the most, let's say, powerful and the strongest kind of politician. When it comes to the leadership, he is the best leader in the history. When it comes to manage the financial kind of affairs of the people, of the society, he is the most careful person. He said that the more I studied about this person, I found that all the positive kind of characteristics that you can even imagine, they are collected and compiled to one person, one single person, who is Imam Ali. Mm. And then he said that he challenged everyone that you can go and search. Mm. Search, can you find such a personality in the history? No, such a multi-dimensional kind of personality in the history. He said the only thing that it attracted me towards Tashayyu is this personality. They do not have in any other religion, in any other school of thought, in any other culture, in any other civilizations. We do not have such a personality.
Okay.
And you may find, for example, heroes in the ancient, for example, Greece. But they are only heroes in the battlefield, you know?
Yeah.
You may find, for example, some very knowledgeable figures in the history of ancient, for example, let's say East, Confucianism, for example. Confucius was a very, for example, knowledgeable person. But when it comes to the other fields, everyone lacks, except Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. So that's why, since he was a Christian professor in university and he converted to Islam, that's why I mentioned his, viewpoint about Amir al-Mu'mineen, not to claim that since we are followers of him, since we are Shia, we are just exaggerating about the personality of him. No. It is what is mentioned by this Christian professor.
Yeah. So you mean this being multidimensional, So this is the feature. This is the important, most important feature in his personality. And yeah, most people who are familiar with his personality appreciate that and understand that. And then, so let's get to another part. Thank you very much for your participation. You know, it's very important to talk about this question. When we talk about Imam Ali as a criterion, it's a symbol. Like, I can't find a word for that. So maybe it's as if you the love toward him can save you.
Yeah.
Oh, so how is it possible? You know, it's why. You know, sometimes they say if you love Imam Ali, I mean, this can pave the way to be in heaven. So,
yeah.
I'm just saying it very, very frankly. You know, I'm just saying it in a very, very direct way.
Okay. Yeah, look, brother, it's true that Imam Ali salam is known as the right path in the interpretation of Sirat al-Mustaqim. It has been said under the interpretation in some books of interpretation or exegesis of the Holy Quran that this Sirat al-Mustaqim is Ali alayhi salam. There is no doubt that he is a role model to reach this right path. But entering heaven or paradise actually requires belief and good deed and righteous action, righteous deeds. So if we believe that we are followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam and we are not men of belief and we are not bringing right actions or righteous actions, so everything would be in vain. So entering paradise requires these first two conditions, that is iman and amal as-salih. So we cannot say anyone who believes in Imam Ali alayhi salam as an imam who will automatically enter the heaven. But we can say the other side. Everyone who believes in Imam Ali alayhi salam as he is naturally a believer and he is also actually doing right actions. But entering the heavens requires these two conditions of iman and amal salih. But who is guiding us to this iman? This is Ali. Who is guiding us to this amal salih? Is Ali. Look, what is amal salih? We learn amal salih, the great good deed and righteous deeds from Imam Ali alayhi salam. The brother talked about generosity of Imam, about the courageousness of Imam, about the knowledge of Imam, about different characteristics of his personality. So all these are the things that tells us how to do, how to perform different kinds of actions. So and when we have these two, naturally, automatically, we shall be guided and we shall be led to the source of this beauty, to the source of this salvation way, which is Ali alayhi salam, because he is the manifestation of iman and amal salih. As for iman, as his belief, he was the first person who believed in Islam. As his righteous action, he was the person who all of his actions were salih and righteous. So he can be a role model for us, and his love and his and his love and obeying him will, inshallah, hopefully lead to entering the paradise, having all these conditions. But to call a person, for example, a Muslim or not Muslim, or I don't know, to limit paradise for a certain group of people, no, it's not a good, I think, way to talk about. But we want to say, who is manifestation of Iman al-Ali? And we learn all the things from him, and this, inshallah, all of them gather and will help us to enter paradise.
So you mean, correct me if I'm wrong, so this acceptance, I mean, toward Imam Ali alayhi salam can be a winning card to be successful in your life. Is this...
I'm trying to correct a prevalent mistake which is in the society that believe in Ali and do whatever you like, you know?
Yeah, this is unfortunately, I'm just trying to just...
But I want to say this, Ali that we are talking about is manifestation of Iman and Amal Salih. belief in good and righteous deeds. So let's say that, for example, a person in that corner of the world just believes that Ali was the first imam, or Ali was a good person. Is it enough for him to enter? Look, this Ali, we have to understand who this Ali is. We need to analyze this Ali. Who is Ali? What did he do that he became Ali? That all of the world is in love of this personality. So that's why I want to say that just saying and believing in Ali alayhi salam helps a person to enter the heavens and paradise, I think is not a good understanding of the issue. But to be exact, I think all this thing, to analyze the personality of Imam Ali, to know what made Ali Ali, is the thing that, inshallah, helps us to enter paradise. Because he came to guide us. He was appointed to guide the humanity to the right path. And he is manifestation of the right path and Salat al-Mustaqim.
So I think you raised an issue just over here.
Yeah.
So how to know Imam Ali, the ways... Some people out there are listening, among our listeners, they want to truly understand and appreciate his personality. Mm-hmm. Just 1 minute. Is there any shortcut?
Within 1 minute, let me give you this example. Nowadays, for example, the youth who play football, yeah, they love, for example, the footballers like Ronaldo, I don't know, Messi, these kind of footballers. You know, when they love these footballists, they try their best to become like them. You know, mm-hmm. they try hard to become like them in football. If you love Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, you have to try your best to become like Ali alayhi salatu wasalam in iman, in faith, in all those positive characteristics that Imam had. It doesn't mean that if you love someone and try not to get like that, yeah? So that's why the followers, the true followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen are those people who try their best to get proximity to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Of course, we cannot become like Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, but of course, we can get proximity or nearness to Imam Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam by our deeds, by our actions, mm-hmm. by our thought, you know. Otherwise, we cannot be considered among the followers of Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Following is not only a claim, you have to practically be the follower. The same way that you try to be like, for example, like an actor or like an... a leader, like a political figures, like athletes, all these figures that you try to be like them, yeah, if you're a follower of them, you try to be like them. You wear, for example, the same clothing, you, for example, act like them, yeah?
No.
So, of course, the same is the case with the followers of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu.
Just one sentence to add to the explanations of the Sheikh. I don't want this, what I said, to become a source of ambiguity for the listeners. It's quite famous that we believe that حُبُّهُ Jannah, that is, the love of Imam Ali alayhi salam is Jannah. But suppose that you are in love with someone and you have a lover and you are his beloved. I don't know, the relationship between lover and beloved. What do these two do for each other? This love is out of nothing, or out of sacrificing each other both sides for each other. So I mean, when we became like this, and we understood Ali in this sense, then it means that we are lovers, and this love, inshallah, hopefully leads us to Jannah and to paradise. So the love has its own circumstances, requirements. So when the requirements of a pure and true love has been seen, then yes, this love definitely will lead us to Jannah.
Yeah, maybe to those of those listeners outside, maybe you need to follow these ideas. Try some of these thoughts mentioned. And then you can search online to find some other ways to follow to find a way to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Thank you for your You're thoughts welcome. And for your comments.
Thanks to you, bro.
Yeah, so that's all the time we have. Thank you all for listening, and may the mighty bless you all.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها شفاعة أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Ministry of Defence's report has found that British troops who served in Iraq and Afghanistan were at 80% greater risk of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. According to government figures, almost 30,000 troops from across the United Kingdom's armed forces are medically unfit for combat operations due to physical injuries and mental health issues. The problem is greatest in the British Army, where only 53,000 troops out of a total of around 75,000 personnel are currently fully fit for frontline operations. That means that 30% of all troops in the British Army, or 3 in 10 soldiers, would not be fully fit to fight in a conflict now. The injury crisis will heap further pressure on the new Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, following the disclosure that all three services are significantly under strength. Overall, according to numbers released by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, 28,664 personnel across all three of the armed forces are currently not fully fit for combat. while some of those could deploy overseas in an emergency as part of a large force, many would not be able to take part in combat missions or even leave a secure base because they have been medically downgraded. The manpower shortage has already prevented Britain from deploying aircraft carriers for the operation against the Yemeni army in the Red Sea. In solidarity with the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, the Yemeni armed forces have targeted ships in the Red Sea with owners linked to Israel or those going to and from Israeli ports. In response, the United States and Britain have formed a military coalition against Yemeni forces in the Red Sea and have endangered maritime navigation in the strategic waterway. As the Telegraph revealed on Saturday, 13th of January, the £3 billion carrier Queen Elizabeth cannot yet be sent to the region because its support ship, RFA Fort Victoria, is operating on a skeleton staff, keeping it in a shipyard in Liverpool. Last week, the Telegraph revealed the recruitment crisis is forcing the Royal Navy to decommission two warships, Westminster and Argyle, so that the new class of Type 26 frigates can be staffed. According to the Ministry of Defence, the British Army currently has around 74,110 personnel, but only 53,192 of those are fit for operations, or what the military calls medically fully deployable. A Freedom of Information document obtained by the Telegraph reveals that 9,217 soldiers are classed as medically limited deployable, meaning that they can deploy on operations but will only be able to conduct certain duties. A further 7,449, almost 1 in 10 of all soldiers, cannot be deployed at all and are classified as medical non-deployable. Comparisons with the number of injured troops from July of 2021 appear to show that the problem is getting worse. In July of 2021, there were 13,248 troops across the armed forces classified as non-deployable, but by July of 2023, the latest figures available showed that the number had grown to 14,743. A further 7,921 personnel were classed as being of limited deployability. The classification means they have either a persistent but relatively minor injury, such as a back problem, or an injury that is close to recovery, such as a ligament damage. According to government figures, there are 29,220 personnel serving in the Royal Navy and the Royal Marines, while a further 29,010 personnel serving in the Royal Air Force. But the Ministry of Defence figures show there are currently just 21,649 fully fit sailors in the Royal Navy, while the RAF has just 19,466 fit personnel. The Freedom of Information request reveals that across the British Armed Forces, 13,727 troops have been downgraded from frontline duties because of musculoskeletal injuries suffered in training or from combat. But the document also shows 4,214 troops cannot deploy on combat operations because of mental health problems. Meanwhile, the number of troops being treated for orthopedic and spinal injuries under the National Health Service Fast Track Surgery contract has more than doubled in the last 4 years. In 2020-2021, 203 were treated under the scheme, but in 2023-2024, the Ministry of Defence predicts up to 540 will receive fast-track treatment in the NHS. Another British newspaper, the Daily Mirror, has also covered the same story and tells us more. The recruitment crisis facing the British Armed Forces has led the new Defence Secretary Grant Shapps to decide to mothball the amphibious assault ships Albion and Bulwark. It has since emerged that the Royal Marines are currently 600 troops short of their target figure, and that the British Army and the Royal Navy are also short of personnel amid claims that the so-called Generation Z is unwilling to join up. According to new figures, British Army recruitment has been below target every year for more than a decade. Data uncovered by Labour Party showed that recruiters signed up 5,560 regular soldiers last year when their target was 8,220, leaving a gap of 2,660 personnel. In the worst performing year of 2018-2019, there was a deficit of 4,130 troops, with 5,860 soldiers recruited when the army needed 9,990 soldiers. Colonel Phil Ingram, a former army intelligence officer, said, "The Ministry of Defence has serious recruitment problems. They can't recruit enough to replace those leaving, and it seems a large percentage of those they keep in are not fit to fight." He added, "This is a clear indication of a broken system, and the Ministry of Defence needs to realise this and come up with a plan to fix it quickly." Colonel Phil Ingram claimed, "Otherwise, in a world growing more unstable by the day, our very national security could be compromised because we might find ourselves in a situation where we need a large number of troops very quickly and we haven't got them." In the meantime, shock figures revealed a record 1 in 8 serving British troops are seeking mental health support. Almost 21,000 went to their GP or to the armed forces last year with depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, or other psychological issues. It is the most since records began in 2012, when 5,404 individuals sought help. And the annual Ministry of Defence report on mental health in its ranks revealed some 4,394 women, a quarter of all female members of the British Army, Navy and the Royal Air Force, reached out. The document noted that the rate statistically significant increased in the past year, and this could be in part related to cost of living pressures, while the Ministry of Defence chiefs also cite reduced stigma around seeking help as a driver of the surge.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.